ॐ पूर्णमदः पूर्णमिदं पूर्णात् पूर्णमुदच्यते पूर्णस्य पूर्णमादाय पूर्णमेवावशिष्यते ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। Good. I think we need to put the screen down a little bit further. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. All right. So we are continuing in our study of the Akshara Brahmana. Akshara, a word representing Brahman. And here, as we commented before, Gargi returns, with two more questions for Yajnavalkya. And we reviewed all of that in the last class, so we'll just pick up the thread here. Before we return to the verses, just to get the big picture, this Upanishad, through the vehicle of Yajnavalkya, is teaching us who and what is Brahman. And we can understand that in teaching Brahman, there are two different aspects going on here. Maybe one of the reasons sometimes Vedanta gets confusing is we use words like Brahman in different senses. So, just to pick up the thread here, let's give this brief introduction. If our scripture is teaching us about Brahman, it's using two different methodologies because there are two different aspects of Brahman. One aspect of Brahman we call Nirguna. Another aspect of Brahman we call Saguna. Nirguna Brahman is the absolute reality because of which everything exists. Being that fundamental reality, it has no particular qualities or characteristics. We say it is satyam jnanam anantam. We say it is satyam, the stuff of reality, jnanam, it's not an inert stuff of reality, it's a conscious stuff of reality, and it is anantam, limitless. So this is Nirguna Brahman. Saguna Brahman, we discussed briefly in the last class. See, Saguna means accompanied by gunas. You might remember that Maya is Trigunatmika. Maya consists of the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. So therefore, Saguna Brahman specifically means Brahman accompanied by Maya, and Brahman accompanied by Maya, which is pure reality, together with this creative capacity that we call Maya, this is exactly who we mean by Ishvara. Creator, sustainer, destroyer. Now, the cause for some confusion might be the fact that we use Brahman for both interchangeably. In fact, it can really drive you crazy if you're reading Shankara's commentary. Sometimes Brahman means Nirguna Brahman, sometimes Brahman means Ishvara. And he doesn't explain it. He assumes you're smart enough to figure it out. If you're reading Shankara's commentary, you better be smart enough to know the difference between Saguna and Nirguna Brahman. So he doesn't distinguish clearly in his commentaries. He doesn't need to. We need to. In our current chapter, we saw Nirguna Brahman being described through a process of negation. That is, Brahman is neither subtle nor gross, Brahman is neither short nor long, neither this nor that, nor this nor that, nor this nor that, neti, neti, through a process of negation. And a couple of classes ago, we gave very elaborately that Arundhati, Darshana, Nyaya, going from star to star to star. We won't return to that. But it's important to note that negation is the only modality for teaching that which is nirguna. Does that make sense? Of course it does. If you start saying, oh, Brahman is like this, Brahman is like that, Brahman is, I don't know, you can't say Brahman is like any, I can't even think of an example because we don't do that in Vedanta. The moment you say Brahman is like this, whatever you say this is, this has some qualities. Qualities which don't belong to Brahman. So we can't say Brahman is like this. In fact, the closest you could come, Brahman is like space. Space is boundaryless. Good. Space is formless. Good. Two hits. Space is an element. Space is that which accommodates physical things. Oops. So you can see, even though of any metaphor, space is the one that would come closest for Brahman. But even if you say Brahman is like space, space accommodates physical objects. Physical objects are a completely different realm from the realm of Brahman. So you cannot say Brahman is like this or that. You cannot use a positive statement. Brahman is. Brahman is. Instead, we use negating statement. Brahman is not this, not that, not this, not that. We do, of course, use a negating, an assertive statement is used, the famous Taittiriya Upanishad statement. Brahman is satyam, jnanam, anantam, brahma. This is not the time and place for a big analysis of that statement. Some of you were here years ago when we studied that Upanishad. And what we discovered is that the meaning of those words was found through negation. First of all, anantam is already a negating word. And it turns out that anantam gets connected to satyam, and anantam gets connected to jnanam. And the statement satyam jnanam anantam brahma, even though it's an assertion, it ends up giving its deeper meaning through a process of negation. Anyway, this is just to finish our definition of how this text revealed to us the nature of nirguna Brahman through negation. Then, if you notice the passage that followed that, which we saw in our next class, we started talking about the one who rules over the universe, the prashasana. Prashastra is the ruler, the one who rules over the cosmos, the one who is the creator, sustainer, destroyer. And here we're getting all positive. We'll come back to this mantra in just a moment. Now we're going to get all positive statements, assertions. Assertions which are not about nirguna Brahman, assertions which are about the nature of saguna Brahman. Now you might, one final comment here. You might say, why should we bother trying to understand saguna Brahman? Why don't we just, as they say, cut to the chase and go immediately for nirguna Brahman? Well, the scripture uses a particular methodology which includes both of these. Don't you think it would include both for a reason? Not just arbitrarily, there should be a reason. Turns out that you'll never understand nirguna Brahman without first understanding saguna Brahman. And the metaphor is, if you're going to cross a stream, there are several stepping stones in that stream. If you try to leap to the far side of the stream, you'll end up wet. On the other hand, if you go methodically from one stepping stone to the next stepping stone to the next stepping stone, You can cross the stream remaining dry. And that really is represents the teaching methodology that we find in this scripture and all of our scriptures. Okay, so we continue our discussion about Saguna Brahman, the one who, just the last mantra we saw in the prior class, Etasya Vai Aksharasya Prashasane Gargi, O Gargi. Etasya Aksharasya Prashasane, under the rule, Prashasana, under the rule, Etasya Aksharasya, of this one, of this Brahman. Because of the rule of this Brahman, Brahman is which, Saguna or Nirguna? Nirguna Brahman can't rule. Nirguna Brahman sounds funny. Good for nothing. Can't do anything. But without Nirguna Brahman, nothing exists. So Nirguna Brahman gives existence to everything. Okay, so under the rule of Nirguna Brahman, all the periods of time are kept in their respective orders. And he says that that the nimisha, the moments, and the muhurta, the periods of time, the aha and ratra, day and night, Ardhamasa, the fortnight, Masa, month, Ritavaha, the seasons, and Samvatsaraha, the years, all of these are Vidritaha, they are held. They are held in check, Tishtanti, and they abide. Can you imagine if a second decided to become a minute long? Or a minute decided to be a second long. And I know it sounds funny, but that's kind of the context, is that the laws of nature are held in check by this conscious being, by the Sishvara, through his rule. Okay, we saw that in the last class. We continue. Etasya vai haksharasya, etasya vai haksharasya, Prashasane Gargi, Prashasane Gargi, Pratyaha Anyaha Nadyaha, Pratyaha Anyaha Nadyaha, Syandante Shwetebhyaha Parvatebhyaha, Syandante Shwetebhyaha Parvatebhyaha. We'll just pick up this last part. Pratichyaha anyaha, pratichyaha anyaha, yam yam cha disham anu, yam yam cha disham anu. That completes the thought. Etasya vai aksharasya prashasane gargi. We've had several mantras beginning with that opening line. O gargi, under the rule, prashasane, under the rule, etasya aksharasya, of this akshara, of this Brahman, of the Saguna Brahman, of Ishvara. Under the rule of Ishvara, this is just lovely poetry. Pratyaha anyaha nadyaha, Anyaha Nadyaha, other rivers, some rivers, Anyaha Nadyaha, some rivers, Syandante flow, they flow, Shwetebhyaha Parvatebhyaha, from the white mountains. White mountains means what? Snowy mountains. Hima means snow. Alaya, place. Himalaya, the place of snow. Here, Shwetebhyaha Parvatebhyaha, from the snowy white mountains. These Anyaha Nadyaha, some rivers. Syandante, some rivers flow. Pratyaha, in an easterly direction. You know your geography better than mine. So easterly direction means towards the Bay of Bengal, which would refer to rivers like the Ganga and Yamuna, which are flowing towards the Bay of Bengal to the east. On the other hand, pratityah anyaha. Anyaha, other rivers, pratityah, flow westward in a westerly direction. Like what? Indus. You know, Indus is mostly in Pakistan, but we still end flowing west in modern Pakistan. So it flows westerly. So some rivers flow in an eastward direction, some rivers flow in a westward direction. Yam yam cha disham anu. Each river flowing, yam yam, each river flowing, disham anu, according to its respective direction. Now you're thinking, oh, come on, of course. So what? What's the point made here? Let me remind you of an observation we made in the last class, and that is, when we're talking about aspects of nature, the way the ancient rishis understood nature is very different than we understand. They understood nature. Remember this discussion? Every aspect of nature was associated with a deity. The sun is a deity. The moon is a deity. The stars are deities. Not only that, but each of these deities have their own minds. Again, this is the ancient worldview, not the modern worldview. Each of these deities had their own minds, their own thoughts, their own free will. So the point then, and Shankara makes this point in his commentary, he says, suppose these rivers were just left to their own devices. No one watched over them. No one made sure that the easterly river should flow into the Bay of Bengal. The westerly river should flow into the, I guess, Arabian Sea, whatever it is. Suppose Ishvara was on vacation and kind of ignored that. And Shankara says the rivers would overflow their banks if you leave these river deities to their own devices. So remember we said this is kind of like one of those Western medieval philosophical proofs for the existence of God. They called it a proof for the existence of God. And the proof went something like this. We live in an intelligent creation. A creation must be a reflection of the Creator. An intelligent creation cannot possibly come from an unintelligent creator, from an unintelligent source. The fact that our universe is intelligent is then held to be a proof that the source of the universe is intelligent. By the way, we don't accept this as a proof, but this was used in medieval European philosophy as a proof. But this is the same kind of logic we're seeing here. So we see in the rivers, we see this orderly flow, and we attribute this orderly flow to Ishvara. We come to understand Ishvara through the intelligence of his creation. That's a nice statement. We come to understand Ishvara by observing, by understanding the intelligence of his creation. Okay, enough. Then, this is the last part of this passage. Etasya vayaksharasya, etasya vayaksharasya, prashasane gargi, dadataha manushyaha prashamsanti. Dadataha manushyaha prashansanti yajamanam devaha darvim pitaraha anvayattaha darvim pitaraha anvayattaha. So as before, etasya vai aksharasya prashasne gargi, O gargi, under the rule, under the control of this Brahman, of this saguna Brahman, of this Ishvara, under its rule, manushyaha dadataha prashamsanti. I'm just putting the words into a more typical prose order. Manushyaha, people. Prashamsanti, they praise. Who do they praise? Dadataha, those who give. Those who give in charity. Why do people praise those who give in charity? Giving in charity happens to be associated with certain rituals. Certain rituals associated with the Vedas. And this, in a little obscure way, is talking about Ishvara as the source of the Vedas. The Vedas are the main scripture. This Upanishad is part of those Vedas. So according to those scriptural passages, not in this Upanishad, but elsewhere in the Vedas, you're supposed to give charity as a part of a ritual, and therefore, manushyaha prashamsanti darataha, people praise those who give. What is the connection? This is evidence of the Vedas being another intelligent creation of the intelligent creator. It gets a little bit more clear here. Yajamanam devaha, you have to connect it with the last word, anvayataha. Devaha, the gods, anvayataha, they depend. Gods aren't almighty, they depend. What do they depend on? Yajamanam. They depend on the worshiper. Again, we have to understand the ancient worldview. The gods get hungry, and it's our responsibility to keep them fed. Yes, it's figurative, but a lot of the symbolism is quite explicit. You put foodstuffs, you put rice, you put ghee into that ritual fire. And that rice and ghee and the seeds and other things you put in that fire are nourishment for the gods. Again, not our modern worldview, but an ancient worldview. And the fact that the gods get their appetites fulfilled through the offerings that are made. The offerings that are made because of the Vedic scriptures. And the Vedic scriptures, again, the intelligent outpouring of the intelligent creator. This final mantra is much more relevant 2,000 years ago, much less relevant today. Okay. And the last example he gives, Darvim Pitraha Anvayataha. So the prior part said the devas depend on offerings made by the worshippers. This one says that the Pitraha, the ancestors whom we want to bless so they go on to better rebirths. So how should we bless them? Well, these pitaraha, the ancestors, anvayataha, they depend on what? Darvim. There is a darvi homa, a ritual in which offerings are made into a sacred fire for the sake of blessing the ancestors. Again, a little obscure, I admit. What is the point is that the scripture is telling you to make offerings for the gods, to make offerings for the ancestors. The scripture is telling you to give charity, and giving charity is praiseworthy. That scripture is the Veda, and the Veda is the intelligent outpouring of an intelligent God. It is the Veda under the intelligent rule of Ishvara. The Vedas guide human behavior. That would be a good way of summarizing this. Under the intelligent control of Ishvara, the Vedas guide human behavior in an intelligent and orderly fashion. So that concludes that current Vakya 9, Mantra 9. Now we go to the 10th mantra.
Yah vai etad aksharam gargi, yah vai etad aksharam gargi, aviditva hasmin loke, aviditva hasmin loke, juhoti yajate tapastapyate, juhoti yajate tapastapyate, Bahuni varsha sahasrani, Bahuni varsha sahasrani.
And we'll just see that much. Yahavai etat aksharam gargi aviditva. Gargi, O Gargi, yaha, one who, aviditva, having failed to know, one who doesn't know, etat aksharam, one who doesn't know this akshara, one who doesn't know this Brahman, one who doesn't know this nirguna Brahman, known through negation, one who doesn't know this saguna Brahman, known through all these scriptural teachings, one who doesn't know, asmin loke, and that non-knower of Brahman, that unenlightened person, basically, that unenlightened person, asmin loke, in this world, in this life, suppose they're very pious. Just because they don't know Brahman doesn't mean they can't be extraordinarily pious. So suppose we're talking about an extraordinarily pious person who, juhoti, does various rituals, makes offerings into ritual fires, yajate, and tapas tapyante, both juhoti, making offerings into a fire, yajate also, making offerings into a fire. They pretty much are synonyms, performing various kinds of ritual worship, sacrifice, and also tapas tapyante, perform spiritual austerities, tapas. So, and suppose that very pious person performs those austerities for how long? Bahuni, many, varsha, many years. How many years? Varsha sahasrani. Sahasra is thousand. Varsha sahasrani, 1,000 years, a millennia. How many millennia? Bahuni. Many millennia. Suppose this pious person performs all these rituals and tapas for many millennia. How much punya karma would you accumulate? You can't even calculate. Bahuni sahasra varshani, you can't calculate in thousands and thousands of years. But watch what comes here. Antavat, oh, you have to repeat. Antavat eva asya, antavat eva asya, tad bhavati yaha vai, tad bhavati yaha vai, etat aksharam gargi, etat aksharam gargi, aviditva asmat lokat, aviditva asmat lokat, praiti saha kripanaha, praiti saha kripanaha. So, talking about that fellow who has done countless rituals over thousands and thousands of years, how much punya karma has he accumulated? You can't count. It's so much. But about that punya karma, antavat eva asya tad bhavati. Asya, of him, tad bhavati, the punya karma accumulated by him, that punya karma is antavat, limited. It may be a very big number, but it's not an infinite number. And what's the significance of that? You might think, come on, big number, infinite number, what's the big difference? If it's a big number, it means he goes, oh, what a funny metaphor. Suppose he goes to the highest possible heaven, whatever you want to call that one, the highest of the heavens. But as you all know, in heaven, you exhaust your karmas. And when your karmas are exhausted, you get reborn back into some other kind of condition. The fact that he has so much karma accumulated simply means that he makes it to the very highest of the heavens. But here's the silly metaphor I just thought about. It's like instead of going into a cheap hotel, you go into a really costly hotel and you burn through your money so fast, you know, $1,000 a day in this really costly hotel. If you went into a cheap hotel, you could stay there longer. But because you went into this costliest hotel, you burn through your money very quickly and then you have to leave. So here, this fellow with this massive amount of punya karma makes it to the highest heaven, but the charges are very high there, apparently. And so he burns through the karma very quickly. The point is that the mere performance of ritual yields you a limited result, a result that will eventually come to an end. Even if it takes you to the highest heaven, that result will eventually come to an end. Just to remind you of something very obvious, we call it karma phala for a reason. Phala, as you know, literally means fruit. So why would we call it the fruits of our actions? Why not call it the rocks? Instead of calling it a fruit, why not call it a rock? We call it a fruit for a very good reason. Fruit decays. If you put a banana on your table and leave it there for several weeks, you know what I mean. Fruit decays. So karma phala is that which decays by nature. So no matter how much punya karma this fellow has accumulated, being so incredibly pious, antavat, it is limited. If he makes it to the highest heaven, he will definitely return. Yaha vai etat aksharam gargi aviditva. O gargi aviditva, that person, yaha aviditva, that person having not understood, aviditva, having not understood etat aksharam, having not understood that Brahman. What about that person? Asmat lokat praiti, when he dies and goes on, asmat lokat, from this world. So when he dies, leaving this world with his huge basket of punya karma, so he checks into the highest loka with his huge basket of karma, and he discovers that the charges are so high, that basket of karma is used up very quickly. Therefore, saha kripanaha, that person is considered pitiable. Saha, he is kripanaha. He is lowly, he is pitiable. He deserves your pity because he is so misguided as to think that through this massive effort in accumulating punya karma, he could gain moksha. Moksha is distinguished as a condition which doesn't end. Why does moksha not come to an end? Collecting punya karmas, going to some high loka, comes to an end because it's karma phala, it's the result of your effort. And your effort will always be finite, and your finite efforts will always give a finite result. Then how can moksha not be finite? In a sense, you made an effort to come for class tonight. Is that a finite effort or an infinite? Well, on a snowy night, it's a little bit extra. It's an extra effort to make it here on a snowy night, but it's not an infinite effort. So if your efforts to gain moksha are finite, then you would think that the results of moksha, the result which is moksha, should also be finite, except for the fact that moksha is really not the result of your effort. In fact, in spite of your effort, has it come? You're making a big effort, and it may or may not come, because moksha is not a matter of effort. Of course, we know without effort, it definitely won't come. You know that, right? Okay. But mere effort does not produce moksha. What produces moksha? Jnanameva mokshaha. Moksha is a matter of knowledge, not a matter of effort. And knowledge is not a phala. Karma has a phala. Jnanam is jnanam. Knowledge doesn't go away. And I know you're going to say, but Swamiji, we forget. Forgetfulness. Forgetfulness is you forget information. We're not talking about information. We're talking about self-knowledge. You don't forget who you are. So this knowledge is not subject to decay in the way that karma pala is. And this mantra concludes.
Ata yaha etat aksharam gargi. Ata yaha etat aksharam gargi. Viditva asmat lokat praiti. Viditva asmat lokat praiti. Saha brahmanaha. Saha brahmanaha. Ata, now, yaha etat aksharam gargi, o gargi, etat aksharam viditva. Before we had a viditva, now we have viditva.
So suppose yaha, this person, viditva, having understood etat aksharam, this Brahman, this nirguna Brahman, this saguna Brahman, suppose he understands. And asmat lokat praiti, and he leaves praiti, he leaves asmat lokat from this world, he dies and leaves this world. The other fellow was called the fellow who didn't know, saha kripanaha, that person is pitiable. But the person who knows and dies, leaving this world, saha brahmanaha. And here brahmana means one who knows Brahman. It means an enlightened person. What a difference. Viditva and aviditva. Having discovered, this is a wonderful statement, comes in the Keno Upanishad, expresses the same idea in a very lovely way. The Keno Upanishad mantra says, Iha cheda vedit ata satyamasti. A few of you might remember this. He says, if you discover Brahman, then satyam asti, you have discovered truth. On the other hand, na cheda vedit, if you fail to discover Brahman, mahati vinashtihi, the loss is immeasurable. Allow me to paraphrase that. In any effort, the gain or loss depends on what you're going for. If you're going for something really meager and you lose out, no big deal, right? But here, if you're going for discovering Brahman, the ultimate goal of life, and we'll see Shankara's commentary on that shortly. If you're trying to discover Brahman, the ultimate goal of life, if you gain that goal, you have found it. If you fail to gain that goal, how great is your loss? The Keno Upanishad mantra says, Mahati vinashtihi. Your loss is immeasurable, failing to discover that. Okay, notice that this mantra is criticizing rituals, right? It is. Because this mantra opened by talking about that guy who does this, what did it say? It said, Juhoti Yajate Tapastapyate. This person does various rituals and various kinds of austerities for many millennia, it says. So he's engaged in all these rituals which are mandated by the Vedas. And here, it's being criticized. Wait a minute, isn't this part of the Vedas? What was the rituals that are taught in the Vedas are criticized by the Vedas. Correct. Absolutely correct. The rituals that are taught in an earlier part of the Vedas, a part known as the Brahmana. Some of you know that the Vedas have four parts, right? the Samhita, the prayers or hymns of the Veda, the Brahmana, the rituals of the Veda, the Aranyaka, the meditations of the Veda, and the Upanishads, the last section of the Veda, which is what we're studying. So the Brahmanas, which occur earlier, you also know that, let me just put it more simply. A very common division in the Veda is to distinguish between the Karma Kanda and the Jnana Kanda. Let's see that. Instead of, well, song, I'm using all these fancy words. Just most of you know, but just in case you don't know. Samatha, Brahmana, Aranyaka, and Upanishad. Okay, these are the four sections of the Veda. There are four Vedas. Each of the Vedas have all four of these sections. And the Samhita is mostly the hymns. The Brahmana contains the ritual instructions. The Aranyaka are meditations. But meditations associated with these hymns and rituals. Really speaking, these first three parts go together. The first three parts, these hymns are used in the performance of these rituals. These meditations are used in the performance of these rituals. So these first three parts collectively are known as Karma Kanda. Kanda meaning section. The section of the Veda that deals with karma. The word karma in the Veda means ritual. Karma means action in general, but in the context of Veda, it means Vaidika karma, it means ritual action. So this karma here means ritual. So the first three parts of the Veda deal with ritual. The last part obviously doesn't. It deals with jnanam, knowledge, which is why it is called the Jnana Kanda. It deals with spiritual knowledge, knowledge of Brahman. So what we're seeing now that we're studying Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, we're studying the last part of the Veda, and the Brihadaranyaka and other Upanishads also criticize the rituals that are taught in the Karmakanda. Now you might wonder, why is there the Karmakanda at all? I mean, if the rituals are going to be criticized later, why does the Veda bother teaching them in the first part, in the first place? Why does it even bother? There's several ways of understanding that. The most obvious is that not everyone is ready to study Upanishads. The Vedas are meant for everyone, but Upanishads are not meant for everyone. It takes a certain orientation, a certain kind of person, to really be ready to penetrate what the Upanishads teach. Since the Vedas have to be a source of guidance for everyone, therefore, for others who are not ready for the Upanishads, we have the rituals are taught. But now, even for those who want to study the Upanishads, I said you have to be ready to study the Upanishads. How do you get ready for studying the Upanishads? In a very classical sense, you get ready for studying the Upanishads by doing all these rituals. I know in modern times it's almost gone, but the sense is any form of prayer or worship will prepare us for this Upanishadic inquiry that we're engaged in. So I'm just explaining why the Vedas include two apparently contradictory subject matters. Notice I said apparently. They're not truly contradictory. Why? Because two ways. They serve different groups of people is one way of understanding. Second way of understanding, Karma Kanda gets us ready for the Jnana Kanda. So in that way, they're not truly contradictory, but most certainly, the Upanishad can afford to criticize. If you're already studying the Upanishad, you're ready to hear this criticism. And its criticism comes in many Upanishads. comes very strongly in the Taittiriya Upanishad as well. Okay. Oh, I wanted to share this. Shankara has an interesting observation here. We've said that this is like a proof for the existence of Ishvara, recognizing the intelligence of creation leads us to recognize the intelligence of the Creator. Here Shankara says, itaha cha asti, and from this, which means what? From this exposition of the intelligence of creation, from this exposition, tad aksharam yasmat agnane. He gives a different argument. This is a second argument for the existence of Ishvara. This is Shankara's argument. You won't find this one in Western philosophy anywhere. Listen to this. Is Shankara's an example? By the way, when we use logic, we're not using logic to prove anything. We use logic to support what we see in the scripture. And what we see in the scripture is what the rishi has discovered. So what is the anubhava, what is the experience of the rishis, which is taught to us in the scripture, that is supported by the use of logic. So this is not exactly a proof, but using logic to support what the scripture teaches, which is what the rishis discovered. So itaha cha asti, from this, and from this means from this vakya we just studied, this mantra that says that if you don't discover Brahman and you die, saha kripanaha, that person is pitiable. But if you discover Brahman and then you die, who cares? You made it. So, based on that, itaha cha asti, and from this statement that I just paraphrased, yat aksharam yasmat agnane, when that Brahman is not known, niyata samsara upapattihi bhavitavyam tu, then one certainly undergoes suffering in life. If that Brahman is not discovered, one certainly undergoes suffering in life, in fact, in life after life after life. But tad vijnanat tad vichedaha. But when that Brahman is known, tad vichedaha, there is the loss of that suffering, the suffering of worldly life. Why is this considered like a proof or logical support? The term used is vidvat anubhava, the experience of the wise ones, the experience of enlightened ones. Of course, we're talking about the rishis, who were the enlightened ones. So here, this text is telling you about the experience of the enlightened ones. They're saying, the enlightened ones are telling us that if you fail to get enlightened in this life, you blew it. And the enlightened ones are telling us, if you gain enlightenment in this life, you have found the ultimate treasure of life. This is the vision of one who's enlightened, which means we should pay attention because they're telling us their own experience. Through this scripture, we're learning the experience of Yajnavalkya and so many others. So this then is held sort of as a proof. What is the proof? The experience of enlightened ones. That when the enlightened ones discovered Brahman, they were freed from suffering. And they observed if one does not discover Brahman, then they are not freed from suffering. This then becomes a proof for Brahman. And Brahman being the cause, discovery of Brahman being the cause for enlightenment. Anyway, you can just see some of Shankara's observation here. To introduce the next mantra, by the way, we're almost at the end. Good. To introduce the next mantra, Shankara has. Sometimes Shankara will introduce an opposing point of view to introduce something, a Purva Paksha. So he introduces the next mantra with this Purva Paksha. Agnehi dahana prakashakatvat swabhavikam. He says that Agni, that fire burns and shines. Shankara says, that's natural. That the sun shines and the moon shines is natural. That rivers flow east and west are natural. That the moments and periods of time are held in their respective periods is natural and not due to a conscious being. This is Shankara's argument. He says, they're all natural, and then he says, prashastratvam achetanasya eva. He says, then, why not say that the controller, if all of these factors of nature are swabhavikam natural, they're natural meaning they're not governed by anyone, then why should we attribute knowledge to the Creator? Why should we attribute sentiency to the Creator? This is Shankara's argument. He's questioning that very basic argument. We live in an intelligent universe, and the intelligence of the universe suggests that the universe came from an intelligent source. And here Shankara says, should you really assume that? This is his introduction. So he challenges it and then introduces the next mantra, which we can see right now. Tat vai he tat aksharam gargi. Tat vai e tat aksharam gargi. Adrishtam drashtra. Adrishtam drashtra. Ashrutam shrotra. Ashrutam shrotra, amatam mantra, amatam mantra, avignatam vignatra, avignatam vignatra. Breaking these words for you, as always. So, Shankara introduces this verse by questioning the very existence of intelligence. He says, how can you be so sure that the source of this creation possesses intelligence? And his answer is, if you really get it, it's a wonderful answer. This is his answer. He says, Tat vai etat aksharam gargi, o gargi, that which we call aksharam, that which we call Brahman, and here we're talking, saguna Brahman and nirguna Brahman, that which we call Brahman, o gargi, is what? Actually, we're talking about nirguna Brahman here. So he says, that which we call nirguna Brahman, o gargi, is the adrishtam drashtra. Drashtra means seer. Adrishtam, unseen. The unseen seer. Ashrutam shrotra. Shrotra means hearer. Ashrutam, unheard. The unseen seer. The unheard hearer. Nice poetry. Amatam mantra. The unthought thinker. And avignatam vignatra, the unrecognized recognizer, referring to buddhi. Uncognized cognizer, that's better. Uncognized cognizer. Is that what it is? Knower. Unknown knower is also fine. Unknown knower, uncognized cognizer. What is he saying here? Adrishtam drashtra, seer, mantra, thinker, vignatra, knower. What are we talking about? Consciousness, right? Consciousness is the drashtra, the seer, which can never be seen, can never be objectified. We've had this discussion here before. Consciousness can never become an object of knowledge. You can never observe consciousness in any way whatsoever, because consciousness is the observer and not the observed. A metaphor I've used before, but I don't think I've given in this class. Suppose you're looking through the microscope. I've given several microscope and metaphors. Suppose you're looking through the microscope, looking for whom? You're looking for yourself. Does that make any sense? You will never see yourself because you're looking in the wrong direction. You should be looking this way. In that way, consciousness cannot be observed, cannot be seen, adrishtam, cannot be heard, ashrutam, cannot be the object of thought, amatam, cannot be an object of knowledge, avignatam. Why? Consciousness is that because of which you see, because of which you hear, because of which you think, because of which you know. Atma is that consciousness. This is a consciousness. Now, what's the significance here? We're suddenly talking about consciousness. What was our topic? I thought our topic was... I've already erased it. I thought our topic was Brahman. Watch this. How is Brahman known? So, Nirguna Brahman, we saw, was known through that process of negation. Not this, not that, not this, not that, not this, not that. Remember that in the prior class. That Nirguna Brahman, known through negation. Everything in the world is subject to negation. True? Everything in the world is subject to negation except for what? I'll give you a moment. Everything in the world is subject to negation. Everything. Is subject. Everything is subject as being not Brahman. That's the chair is not Brahman, the table is not Brahman, etc., etc., etc. Everything. Remember the star metaphor, negating that star, negating the next star. But remember that Arundhati Darshana Nyaya eventually led you to a discovery, to discover the actual double star that is Arundhati and Vashishta. So then, if we negate everything in the world, how would that lead us to discover Brahman? Because we negate everything in the world except for what? Except for the one doing the negation. And the one doing the negation is you, that consciousness. Consciousness cannot be negated because consciousness is the essence of the negator. And that's how negation leads us to consciousness. That's how Brahman is known how? As your own consciousness. Now, it doesn't sound right to say your consciousness because you don't have special rights to that consciousness. It is the one consciousness, Ekam Advitiyam, the one and only consciousness which pervades the universe, which is manifest in your mind and your mind and your mind and my mind. That consciousness is the reality because of which everything exists. That consciousness is Brahman. So Shankara very cleverly introduces this by saying, the way you know Ishvara is conscious is by knowing you are conscious. You are that consciousness, which is Brahman, and that Brahman therefore exists. And therefore, that Brahman being the source of the universe, intelligent source of the universe. Then this mantra concludes. Na anyat ataha asti drashtra. Na anyat ataha asti drashtra. na anyat atah asti shrotra, na anyat atah asti shrotra, na anyat atah asti mantra, na anyat atah asti mantra, na anyat atah asti vignatra, na anyat atah asti vignatra. Na asti drashtra atah anyat. Just changing the word order. Na asti drashtra. There is no other anyaha drashtra. I should change the word order. There is na anyaha drashtra asti. There is no other seer ataha than this. There is no other seer than this. There is no other shrotra hearer than this. There is no other mantra, no other thinker than this. There is no other vignatra, cognizer, knower. There is no other knower, ataha, than this. Meaning what? The point I made just a moment ago. It's not your consciousness. Why? He says, there is no other seer than your seer. There is no other thinker than your thinker. There is no other consciousness than your consciousness. Which means, how can it be yours? It's the only consciousness. There is only one consciousness. That consciousness is the consciousness because of which you and I are sentient. That consciousness is the consciousness because of which Ishvara is sentient. You and I, as individual beings, are sentient because of consciousness. Ishvara, as the creator, sustainer, destroyer, is sentient because of that same consciousness. And there is no other consciousness than that. And to conclude, etasminnu khalu akshare gargi, etasminnu khalu akshare gargi, akashah otah cha protah cha yati, akashah otah cha protah cha yati. O Gargi, etasmin akshare khalu, indeed, nu also means indeed, etasmin akshare, on this akshara, on this Brahman, akashaha, space, which we said meant, remember we had this discussion long ago, space meant Hiranyagarbha. This is Gargi's second question. And what Yajnavalkya says is etasmin akshare, on this akshara brahma, on this Brahman, akashaha, which was a code word, an unusual word for Hiranyagarbha, on this akasha, I'm sorry, on this Brahman, Hiranyagarbha otahacha protahacha is woven, which is to say that the reality, even because of which Hiranyagarbha exists, that underlying reality is Brahman. This is an answer to Gargi's second question. And that was her second sharpened arrow, right? So the arrow that she was convinced that no one could withstand, and not even Yajnavalkya. Yajnavalkya here concludes by saying that Brahman is the source for everything without exception. Brahman is the underlying reality because of which everything exists, everything without exception. And to underline the sense of everything, listen, Shankara just gets really poetic here. He says, yat eva sakshat aprokshat brahma that which we understand as the immediacy of Brahman, yaha atma sarvantaraha, that immediacy which is Brahman. Immediacy of Brahman means what? The reality because of which this table exists, the reality because of which this chair exists, the reality because of which this Swami exists. That's how what we mean by an immediacy of Brahman. He says, Sah yaha atma, that is atma, sarvantaraha, the atma dwelling in all. We saw that statement so many times. It is ashanayadi samsara dharma atitaha. It is absolutely beyond all worldly suffering. Yasmin akashaha otaha protaha cha. It is that in which this entire universe is woven, that because of which everything exists. Esha prakashta. This is the ultimate limit. Esha paragatihi. This is the ultimate goal. Etat param brahma. This is absolute Brahman. Etat prithivya dehe akashantasya satyasya satyam. This is the satyasya satyam, the truth of the truth, because of which all the elements exist. The underlying stuff or reality because of which everything exists. So Shankara ties that up very nicely, leading us then to the final statement of this section. Saha uvacha. Saha uvacha brahmanaha bhagavantaha brahmanaha bhagavantaha tat eva bahu manyedvam tat eva bahu manyedvam yat asmat namaskarena muchyedvam tat asmat namaskarena muchyedvam. Correct, yat. So, sa, she, meaning Gargi, remember Gargi? Saha uvacha, she said, Gargi said. Gargi, after having her second question so fully and completely answered by Yajnavalkya, Gargi addresses the assembled brahmanas and says, He brahmanaha bhagavantaha, O blessed pious brahmanas, tat eva bahu manyedvam. He said, this you should consider, manyedvam, you should consider yourself, manyedvam, you should consider bahu, you should consider it great. What should you consider great? Yat asmat namaskarena muchedvam. He says, yat, that which, asmat, from him, from Yajnavalkya, if muchedvam, if you can become free from Yajnavalkya, which means if you can get away from him, namaskarena, with merely a namaskara. If you can get away from him just by saying namaskara, he says, bahu manyedvam, you should consider yourselves fortunate. Now, the point is that she just went through this long dialogue with him and she was defeated by him. And she's warning the others. She's warning them that if you get into a dialogue with him, you will also be defeated. Therefore, if you can get by just by saying namaskar, namaskaram, and get out of the sabha, they're in this meeting hall, I suppose. This is Janaka's meeting hall. So if you can get out of the meeting hall without engaging him in dialogue and being defeated, if you can get away with a mere namaskara, you are indeed fortunate. Navai jatu yushmakam himam navai jatu yushmakam himam kaschid brahma udyam jetayati kaschid brahma udyam jetayati tataha ha vachaknavi upararama tataha ha vachaknavi upararama. So Gargi concludes by saying, Yushmakam, among you, najatu, no one, najatu kaschit, no one at all, no one at all, jeta, could defeat imam, this one, this Yajnavalkya, who is Brahma Udyam, who is expounding Brahman. He says, none of you, Yushmakam, none of you could possibly defeat Yajnavalkya in terms of expounding on Brahman. Brahmodyam, expounding on Brahman. None of you could possibly defeat Yajnavalkya in unfolding the nature of Brahman, iti, thus, tataha, thereafter, ha, as it was, Vachaknavi, which is the family name for Gargi. Gargi was the daughter of Vachaknavu. Vachaknu. She was the daughter. Vachaknu. So she, Gargi, tataha, thereafter. What did she do? Upararama. She fell silent. For the second time. First time she was threatened with her head falling off. Second time she just fell silent. She has been defeated. So remember, all of this is everyone, each one of these brahmanas and Gargi were challenging Yajnavalkya, who is ready to walk away with the cows and gold. And so one by one by one, we've seen these challenges to Yajnavalkya. There's one more section left which challenges Yajnavalkya. We're not going to see it. We're going to skip it. But let me just give you, just to tie up this subject matter. So the last person to challenge Yajnavalkya is another brahmana called Shakalya. You know, in every group there's like a wise guy. I think the Shakalya was a little bit like a wise guy. Because, you know, he asks a question. So Gargi has just said, hey, look at this. My two questions, like sharpened arrows, were so profound, no one else could possibly come up with better questions than that. And Yajnavalkya was able to answer. Therefore, all of you should just give up. But then this Shakalya says, no, I'm going to ask. He's the last one. And he's a wise guy. He's going to ask questions. And his questions are a little bit strange, a little absurd. So Shakalya asked Yajnavalkya, how many gods are there? Yajnavalkya says, there are 333 and 3,003 gods. Huh? And then Shakalya says, oh, how many gods are there? And Yajnavalkya says, there are 33 gods. Then Shakalya says, oh, there are 33 gods? And then Yajnavalkya says, there are 6 gods. Shakalya says, there are 6 gods? Yajnavalkya says, there are 3. There are 3 gods? Yajnavalkya says, there are 2. There are 2 gods? Yajnavalkya says, I'm not making this up. It's in the Upanishad. Yajnavalkya says, there's 1.5. He says, there's 1.5. There's 1.5? There's 1 God. And then they proceed into this rather obscure discussion about what are these groups of gods. So there's a group of 333 gods, there's a group of 3,003 gods, there's a group of 33, there's a group of 6, there's a group of 3, etc., etc. And Yajnavalkya laboriously tells who are all those gods. I think we can skip this. And because they're just all names of gods. Yajnavalkya brings the discussion back to Brahman. But it's interesting that Shakalya's question was off the mark, don't you think? That's why I called him a wise guy. Because he can't think of a very challenging question. So instead, he thinks of a clever question. That's why we call him the wise guy. And what is the outcome? Yajnavalkya gets the cows and the gold, and this section comes to an end. With that, Yajnavalkya has the cows and gold. When we meet next time, then we move to the next section, the most important section, the Jyotir Brahmana, and I'll give that a proper introduction in the next class. Before we'll conclude with our prayers in just one second, I have a note here. I'm supposed to remind you, I don't do this much, in fact I haven't done it at all, I'm supposed to remind you that if you're coming regularly for classes, you're supposed to give a regular donation. So I think you're all giving donations, I don't think it's an issue, but I'm supposed to make these reminders. Okay, we'll conclude.